So the big theme that kind of we're looking at this morning joins together those passages we read earlier on is that Jesus is calling his disciples. Now, what is a disciple? Because when we hear the word disciples, if you are used to being in church and you're in the Bible, then you think of these 12 guys that Jesus had with him. But that's true. But there's more to it than that. A disciple, the word would have been used more commonly, more widely. A disciple would be a student, a learner, a follower of. And as we'll see later on, there are many more disciples than just 12. But we're thinking about Jesus calling his disciples. I want us to see that Jesus called leaders. And he also called many. And he called individuals. So let's think firstly about that calling of leaders. Look at Luke 6. One of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray and spent the night praying to God. When morning came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also designated apostles. To be an apostle is to be sent, to be given a job, to be set about a task. Where was Jesus in verse 12 of chapter 6? He's on a mountainside. There's a kind of symbolism going on here. In Exodus 24, we read of God calling Moses and the leaders to dinner. How's that for an invite? God summons the leaders of Israel, the leaders of his covenant people, up onto the mountain, and they feast with him there. I can't really get my head around that much, except to say that it's a remarkable thing, isn't it? Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up and saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement made of lapis lazuli, as bright blue as the sky. Words fail to describe the glory of this. Now, elsewhere we've been told that no one can see God and live. Elsewhere we discover that we're not fit to come into the presence of God. But here in Exodus 24 we read, God didn't raise his hand against these leaders of the Israelites. They saw God and they ate. Receives these people into his presence. And they feast. Of course, we know that the Bible ends with the marriage supper of the Lamb. That great feasting, that great occasion when you and I, as believers in Jesus, are gathered into the presence of God. That's a delight in him. And to feed with him. When we come together this evening in the Lord's Supper, we get a little taste, a little snack to keep us going until that time. But there's this wonderful way in which God meets with his people. But as there, Jesus calls his disciples together. 12 of them. Reminding them of the 12 tribes. Jesus is constituting a new Israel, if you like, a new community of God's people. And in Exodus, it's connected to the giving of the law. And just after this, Jesus begins teaching. We didn't read it, but Jesus is teaching what in Luke's Gospel is called the Sermon on the Plain. And Jesus is laying down the law, if you like. He's giving the new law, how to live in his new kingdom. There's a symbolism in what's going on. Notice what Jesus did, where he was. He was on a mountain, but what did he do? Jesus went out on a mountainside to pray and spent the night praying to God. That actually doesn't read very nicely, does it? If you were writing it, you'd said that Jesus went out to pray, or you would have written that he spent the night praying to God. You wouldn't have said he went out to pray and he spent the night praying. It's a horrible mouthful. But what is it emphasizing for us? You see how Jesus, God himself, taken on human flesh, feels the need to pray. Before he calls his disciples, he spends time praying first. Do you suppose that Jesus knows what he's doing? Do you suppose that Jesus usually gets it right when he decides things? Does he possess wisdom, knowledge? And yet he spends the night in prayer before this significant decision. And if you were like me and not as wise as Jesus, and not as good at deciding things or knowing what to do, then perhaps we have to learn something and see how our decisions and our actions have to be guided by prayer. Jesus spends the night in prayer before he makes this decision. And how much more must we? And the 12 he chooses are interesting, because there's an enormous diversity here. We read about a zealot, a freedom fighter, a resistance fighter, one of the guys who's standing up against the Roman occupation, trying to repel the invaders. We've got him, and then we've got Matthew, or Levi, the tax collector, the quisling, the collaborator with the occupying power. He's brought those two together. What a diversity. He's brought together a brash, outspoken Peter. And he's brought for us a James, son of Alphaeus, about which we know absolutely nothing except that his name is James. Poor guy, the early church called him James the Lesser, because he's so anonymous. We've got the ones with the fiery tempers. We've got the slightly sceptical ones. We've got the pessimistic ones. We've got the thief who'll become a traitor. They're all Jews, but one of them at least is from a Greek background. He's got a Greek name. Perhaps he's a bit more sophisticated and educated than the others. Certainly the fishermen, perhaps. They're quite expected. They're very different from one another. The leaders that Jesus appoints in his community, in God's kingdom, are different and diverse. We also ought to note this, I think. I don't think it's accidental. They do have something in common. They are all men. Now, I know there's an accusation against the church, against Christianity, that the church is sexist, that Christianity oppresses women. And if you don't support women as pastors or elders in the church, you must be sexist too. Question for you. Was Jesus sexist? Did Jesus not consider women as being equal to men? No, see his dealings with them. We were reading through the Gospel of Luke, and one of the things that is noteworthy in the Gospel of Luke, more than any of the other Gospels, is the way he portrays women. We've already met Elizabeth. Godly Elizabeth. Waiting for the rescue, the redemption of Israel. And the first to recognize Mary and the mother of our Lord. And then with Mary herself, didn't we? And her patience and obedience and faithful submission to God in the face of something shocking. We met Anna, serving in the temple. You read on, you meet in Luke chapter 8, the women who are making Jesus' ministry possible. In chapter 7, Jesus meets a woman and the rest of society has dismissed her, and yet Jesus is receiving her love and her worship. In Luke 23 and 24, we see the central role of the women at the cross and at the resurrection. Is Jesus against women? Certainly not. Is it just that Jesus then is so bound by convention that he can't think outside the box? He can't challenge the orthodox. He just has to do everything the way everybody else does. Well, of course not. We saw last time, didn't we, how he deals with the subject of the Sabbath. How he challenged religious leaders over the Sabbath, over their misunderstanding of it. And how to do so was at the risk of his own life. He gets stoned for breaking the Sabbath. No, we must say that Jesus is not bound by convention. It's not that he can't think differently. He is intentional in everything he does. But yet it seems that as it comes to leadership in the church, that Jesus makes a distinction between the roles of men and women. Not a division. Not saying that one is inferior. Not denying that they are equal, but recognizing that they are different and that God has given them different responsibilities. And that fits in with the rest of the New Testament teaching. It's not about equality. It's not about value. But it's a question of function. The other thing that we ought to see here is that Jesus is calling these disciples. This particular call is a call to leadership. It's not just a call to discipleship. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But he's calling these 12 disciples out of many disciples. In verse 6, he called the disciples to him and chose 12 of them. There's a group, and there's another group. And he's designated them his apostles. And all of us, whether we are men or women, need to be looking to follow and to learn from, to be disciples of the Jesus who calls. Jesus recognizes this new community that he's forming, this kingdom, needs leaders. He's going. He's going to be with them for a few years. He's going to complete his work and he's going to return to the Father. And the task is being entrusted to these apostles, these sent ones, who he is leaving as. And we ought to note this too. It's a plurality of leadership. You got Peter there. Now, Peter's a kind of significant guy, isn't he? Read on in the rest of the Gospels. Read on into Acts. Discover the kind of man he is, the character of him, the strength of him. But this job is too big, even for Peter. It needs a diversity of backgrounds, of gifts. No one of the disciples could do it all. And as we read, you saw, I hope, that the appointing of the disciples is followed then, and it unfolds as we go on into Luke's Gospel, by an expanding of the ministry. Teaching and a deliverance from evil spirits and the bringing of wholeness follows on from the appointing of the leaders there. The work of the church spreads and grows and is now doing things that they didn't and couldn't do before. It couldn't be done by one person. Even the Apostle Peter, even the Apostle John, pick your favourite one of the 12, couldn't have done this on their own, and so God appoints a number of them. Now let me make a bit of application here. I am the pastor, the elder, the leader of the church, this church here that God has given to you, and I'm limited. I'm only one person. And there are some things I'm rubbish at. My wife is nodding, stop. I've been here 6 years this week, and therefore you'll have realised too that there are some things I'm really rubbish at. And instead of wishing that I was somebody that I'm not, or something that I'm not, what we should be looking for, surely, is a biblical pattern. But rather than wondering why the one person can't do everything, just like wondering why the Apostle Peter can't complete everything, we ought to be looking perhaps for a biblical pattern. That God would provide a group of leaders rather than one person. Some churches have what they call a leadership team that does that. Well, I'd rather use that the Bible uses different language. I want to shape our church, our thinking around the language that the Bible uses. The Bible talks about elders who have the responsibility for spiritual leadership and care of the church. And it talks about deacons who serve in the practical matters and care of the church. But there is a an example set for us here that Jesus appoints a plurality of leadership. And Jesus saw fit to spend a heap of time praying over the matter and then appointed the 12. And we ought to perhaps spend a heap of time praying over the matter and ask God to provide us with elders and deacons and give us the wisdom and the insight to identify them. But he also called many, because we read here that he's calling the 12 out of more disciples. And then as he comes down in verse 17 from the mountain to a level place, to the plain, there's a large crowd of his disciples there. Do you see this? The 12 is part of a larger group, and the larger group is part of a crowd of disciples, and you get the impression that there's a number of them. In Luke chapter 10, we read about 72 disciples being sent out. As I say, here in chapter 6, we have a large crowd of his disciples. But the real distinction is, look at chapter 6 and verse 17. There's a large crowd of his disciples there, and a great number of people from all over Judea from Jerusalem. You see, the real distinction is not between the 12, the leaders, and the rest of the disciples. The real distinction is between the disciples and the great number from all over who'd come to hear. Jesus called leaders, and he called them out of the many who he'd called. Jesus called individuals. Jesus called individuals. Think back to chapter 5. We read it earlier on. He's dealing with the fisherman and he's dealing with Levi. I hope you saw as you read that Jesus deals with different people in different ways. Fishermen. Hardy men. Men who were used to physical labor all night long. And Levi, the tax collector, who's used to sitting at a desk. The fishermen they're common, ordinary working people. The tax collector, from what we know of tax collectors in the New Testament, is likely to be a very wealthy man. And likely to have been wealthy in a dishonest way. The fishermen are plain, ordinary people, but they're respectable. You'd quite aptly sit down and chat to them. The tax collector is despised. He's a traitor. He's working for the Romans and he's ripping us off. The calling of the fishermen is miraculous. Did you see it? They've fished all night. They haven't caught anything. And so he says, go and do it again. We've done it all night. We're not going to catch anything, but because you say we will, and they produce this miraculous haul. It's incredible. The calling of Levi is very, very ordinary, isn't it? He sat at the side of the road. Jesus walks past and says, come on then. And he does. So Jesus is dealing with different people in different ways. And yet, there is a commonality about it. Do you see? Jesus calls them. Don't be afraid. From now on you're going to fish for people. So they pulled their boats up on the shore. They left everything and they followed him. Jesus sees Levi. Follow me, Jesus said to him. And Levi got up. He left everything and he followed him. Although there are things that are different, there's this common thread that Jesus, with that authoritative voice that nobody else has, says, follow. And they leave it behind. And they go. What makes a disciple? Well, they are called. They have heard Jesus calling them. They have left everything behind. And they have followed him. This is the distinction. This is the thing that matters. Are we disciples? Are we followers? Or are we the crowd who are just kind of passing along with him? Are those who hear him perhaps, those who are excited to see what he might do, but really they have just a passing interest. Are we those who follow him, those who are devoted to him, or are we just those who travel along with him where it's convenient? One of the big themes that unfolds in this gospel, in Luke's gospel, is the question whether or not we are following Jesus. In Luke 18, we meet a young man who is told that to give up everything and follow Jesus is the way to eternal life. Elsewhere, we're told that being a disciple is costly. It's described in terms of taking up your cross, being willing to die to yourself, no longer putting yourself and your aspirations and your plans and your desires first, but you fade into the background, you die. It is costly. It is hard at times being a follower, a disciple of Jesus. There is a lie out there floating around that being a Christian is a ticket to an easy life. I know most of you know from experience that ain't true. But it's not because there's something wrong with you, it's because there's something wrong with that narrative. To become a Christian, well, you have all the old challenges, all the difficulties you had before, all the things that affect everybody. Plus you have the new challenges and difficulties that come from being a follower of Jesus. Now friends, let me tell you, there is a life of joy. Because those new troubles and the old ones are born with God's help. But we have the unshakable presence of Jesus with us at every step. That the Jesus who loved you and gave his own life in order to rescue you and has been raised up conquering death. Well, there's nothing that can separate you from him. He is worth following. There's another place where John's Gospel, Matthew's Gospel, Jesus says, take my yoke. You know, when oxen are ploughing, they're to pull something, they have a yoke put on them. It's heavy. It constrains them. Binds them. They can't do the thing they wanted to do anymore. Here we're called to walk in step with Jesus, to be yoked to him, chained to him. No longer free, no longer living for yourself, no longer able to do your own thing. A life of service. A life in harness. Yoked. And paradoxically, Jesus says, this is where you get. Come to me, you are weary and heavy laden. In the same passage, he says, and rest. There is a yoke, there is a burden. But it's light. He'll pull it with you. It's easy, it doesn't rub and chafe, it's made to fit you. You will find rest and stillness and freedom from your endless strivings. No longer fighting to find your own way and to satisfy yourself. Jesus says, come to me and I'll give you. This is what it is to be a disciple. Jesus called leaders. And he called many. He called individuals to follow him and to be his disciples. To learn from him, to be in step with him. Are you disciples? Are you, when you hear him call, are you ready to leave everything? Father, we pray to you, we confess before you that so often following is hard. It is perhaps the last. Father, I pray that we would bring our minds, our hearts, our wills, our lives into submission to Jesus. We would take on his yoke. We would walk where he walks. We would follow him. We would learn from him. We would be his disciples. And we would find in that great joy and great rest. I pray it in his good and glorious name.